the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm Megan Marone.
And I'm Annie. We'll start the show with WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce, who visited Brick Arts Media in Brooklyn. He spoke with special project manager Jen Liu and Leon Taylor, manager of the Community Producers Services for Brick's Free Speech Media.
Then we'll hear from WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce again. He recently stopped by the Brooklyn Bridge Park Conservancy's Environmental Education Center. Located in a small building a few feet from the East River, their dedicated staff works to help adults and school children understand local ecology.
Then we will be joined by Devin Franklin, Director of Programs at Flying Deer Nature Center. Flying Deer is a wilderness school and community dedicated to mentoring children, youth, adults, and families.
Then we're back with David Borton with Equality Under the law of physics, that is. And he and I will be discussing the reason why, in terms of our warming planet, we have to go back to living in simpler times and simpler lifestyles.
And later on, we'll be visited in the studio by David King, editor of The Alt. And he will discuss current issues and events in the Capital Region. Let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines. The Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that immigrants, even ones residing in the U.S. lawfully, may be detained indefinitely for committing even minor infractions and crimes. The 5-3 ruling stipulates that immigrants, quote, do not have the right to periodic bond hearings, end quote. NPR reports, meaning that they can be denied the opportunity to post bail and to leave jail. The case, Jennings versus Rodriguez, concerns immigrants with permanent legal status, as well as asylum seekers who turn themselves into authorities at the border. In its decision, the court reversed a previous ruling by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, claiming that the appellate court had, quote, erroneously concluded that periodic bond hearings are required, end quote, by law. Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy testified before Congress on Tuesday about clean energy. During his testimony, Mayor McCarthy said the most valuable real estate in Schenectady and in communities across the country are our light poles. Quote, what we are doing in Schenectady and some communities across the country is looking at the opportunity to add additional features, sensor-based technologies, to the light pole when it is converted to LED fixtures, when that happens. The city is partnering with National Grid, GE, AT&T, Cisco, Presido, Simcon Lighting, and other partners to launch a citywide deployment of smart city technology.
Students, staff, and administrators in the Capital Region are calling on local law enforcement to provide more in-school police presence following the February 14th shootings that left 17 people dead in Broward County, Florida. The New York State Sheriff's Association has asked the state legislature to include funding in the next budget for at least one armed school resource officer at all. 6,750 public and private elementary and high schools in the state. Following last week's winter break, classes resumed locally on Monday for the first full week of school since the Florida tragedy occurred.
Students across the country are protesting against gun violence. About 200 students at Taconic High School in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, walked out of school Tuesday morning calling for change. They walked from the high school building to the track and football field, where they held a moment of silence. The students were carrying signs with messages including, no more silence, end gun violence. Students were accompanied by a lot of the school staff and by Pittsfield police officers all along the route and throughout the rally. They say it's not about pro or anti-gun, but uniting against violence.
Closing arguments are scheduled to begin Tuesday in the bribery trial of a former top aide to Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo. Defense lawyers presented witnesses over 3 days to refute a month of evidence from prosecutors aimed at convincing jurors in Manhattan federal court that Joseph Prococo accepted more than $300,000 in bribes from three businessmen to treat them favorably.
Two Democratic state lawmakers from Manhattan are proposing a statewide ban on the ubiquitous plastic shopping bag and a fee on paper bags. Senators Liz Krueger and Brad Holman said Monday that their legislation is meant to encourage the use of reusable bags. New Yorkers use an estimated 23 billion plastic bags each year, with many ending up in landfills or state waterways. More than a dozen local communities in New York State have adopted bans or fees, but a 5-cent fee approved in New York City was blocked by officials in Albany last year.
For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
As part of an ongoing series profiling community organizations that inspire us, WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce visited Brick Arts Media in Brooklyn. He spoke with Special Projects Manager Jen Liu and Leon Taylor, Manager of Community Producer Services for Brick Free Speech Media.
Brick is an arts and culture organization, as well as media. We are the media end of Brick. We try to provide free and low-cost programming to the community, Brooklyn at large, so that the community has access to both performing arts, arts, and to media. We do that in a variety of ways, both collaboratively and individually as individual programs. Here in media, we focus on providing classes to introduce people to technology and avenues to media so that they can engage media in a way that puts their voice out there in a unique way and shares it with the community.
So in our media-saturated world, it doesn't seem like there's any real shortage of media. What is it that you all do that's different from what's out there already?
Well, I think we provide them with the tools. And I think sometimes people forget that as technology changes, as an individual, you're not always in the position to buy the next new thing or the thing that the industry is moving toward. We provide a space where you don't have to worry about that. You simply have to learn it as technology changes. We make the upgrades and we introduce it to you and you can take advantage of it. And I think beyond the technology, the biggest thing is community. What helps media have legitimacy is its connection to community and its ability to be sincere in the voice that it's sharing. And what drives people creatively is having other voices in the room, sometimes to balance them with different ideas and perspectives, sometimes to share those perspectives and give them the strength to say what it is they need to say. So I think community is what most people come here for. You're an artist who wants to show your art, or you're a performer and you want to share that with people. We give you the tools to project yourself on another stage and share with people who may not have been introduced to you.
So what are the things that you offer people here? What are the categories of services? When you come in here, what can you get?
Well, when you come in, you're going to get education. That's the first step, learning the tools that you will need to share your voice with community. If you've already got access to tools of your own and you're not interested in learning the tools that we are offering, or you've got some of your own and you just don't need those services, you can access our channel time. So that means that you are able to put your program on of any length, if you've already been producing it, on any of one of our four channels. And that's going to be shared with the entire community of Brooklyn through a variety of cable providers throughout the world, through the internet, and through Verizon throughout the five boroughs. Outside of education and distribution, there's also simple access to support. So once you become a certified producer after taking a class, you're now part of a community where you have a liaison who's going to share a list of folks with you who are interested in volunteering and helping on productions, who is going to talk with you about your project before you take out a particular piece of equipment to make sure you understand the tools you're using and if it works for what you're trying to do. You've got a liaison who's designing events that is there to highlight your work alongside other producers' work. So a lot of time you'll get artists and community members producing great things, and they may give up if you don't have a community there to say, hey, we appreciate that, let's talk about what you did. So we provide that level of support to where it's not just creating it, putting it out there and hoping someone hears it, but we also provide sometimes a stage for other people to engage you and talk about the work you just created in a constructive way. I think those are the key things here. And then being a part of an arts organization like Brick, if you're a community producer, You're naturally going to walk through those doors and you're going to see a show that's happening on the lower level that's going to talk about art that you may not have thought about but connects with the work you're doing. Are you going to see a show that exposes you to a different culture, a different way of thinking, something you wouldn't have gotten if you simply picked up a camera and shot it on your own on the outside and then delivered it via internet. So there's just a lot of nuanced avenues where you get introduced to different things that you wouldn't have if you didn't walk through the door.
Okay, impressive. So you're talking about the community of producers here. I'll switch to you, and maybe you could tell us how many people are involved here, and what kind of folks are they? If you generalized about them,
We have average about 1,900 to 1,000 active producer every year here. Active means they are eligible to take out equipment and use our facilities, or they are. And we have, every quarter, we have about average about 550 producers who has channel time, who has time slots on our channels.
And who are these people?
All kinds of people around Brooklyn. You know, we have a lot of religious programs, you know, church submitting their shows. We have artists, we have activists, a lot of them, and just anybody.
Yeah,
it really represents Brooklyn, the variety of this place.
So yeah, you've got the LGBTQ community, you've got the Haitian community. You know, we were looking at our numbers for streaming, who's actually tuning in, and the channel which we air Spanish language programming, Chinese language programming, Haitian programming, cultural centric programming are getting the most hits. And that's because you turn to Fox, NBC, ABC, they're not airing things for those communities particularly. And if they are, it's not by the members of those communities. And so that makes us very unique, where members of those communities are both producing things here in Brooklyn about the communities here in Brooklyn, but a lot of them are also pulling content from back home and sharing it with the community members here. We even had a producer who did a live show in our studio connected with the government of one of the islands as they were making decisions on legislation that would affect those who are sending money from here to home so that they can get information from them and make the best decision. That's completely unique to us. And you're not going to find that in other places. And that really represents our community. It's diverse. It is people from different places, people with different point of views, and people who want to share that with other people.
So you're describing broadcasting, or not even broadcasting, but a communication system that's at its heart non-commercial. You're doing things that can't be found in the commercial media. How does the magic happen? What pays for this?
Cable subscribers. So if you're a cable subscriber in Brooklyn, you should have a voice on cable in Brooklyn. And it is the governance and the laws and the contracts that make that connection that allows this to happen. So for every person who is subscribed to Cablevision, Time Warner, RCN, Verizon here in Brooklyn, a percentage of that goes back into making sure that the community has a voice on those same networks. And I think that's fair. And I think it's necessary. I think community should have access, especially if you're using public land to profit. Why shouldn't the community have an avenue to have a voice in the medium that you're putting out there?
Okay, so Leon, you told me earlier that your career started in public access from your experience at Manhattan Neighborhood Network, but you said you have a corporate television background from Hong Kong Television and Disney. Yeah. Now you've been here at Brick TV for 15 years. What are the differences in your experience?
Here you really have to, you know, it's a community. You interact with all the people from Brooklyn. So that interaction is the most important part, and I really enjoyed it.
And what about as a place to work? Are there differences in just how the operations manage themselves?
Oh, I think back then when I was in Hong Kong, I was just told what to do. And here you can really get involved. You know, as a staff, your voice was heard. And I think that's the most best part about this place. We have very good supervisors, you know, our boss, our board member, they listen. They really listen to what we have to say.
That was Jen Liu of BRIC Free Speech Media in Brooklyn. She and her colleague Leon Taylor spoke to WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce about community media in New York City. For more information, search BRIC Arts Media.
As part of an ongoing series of visits to community centers that inspire our work here at WOOC and our work in the Capital Region, Steve Pierce, the WOOC correspondent, recently stopped by the Brooklyn Bridge Park Conservancy's Environmental Education Center. Located in a small building a few feet from the East River, their dedicated staff works to help adults and schoolchildren understand the local ecology.
So my name is Christina Tobich. I'm an environmental educator at the Brooklyn Bridge Park Conservancy, a nonprofit organization. We are responsible for all the public programming that happens in the park. Most of our programming is free or low-cost programming so that we can serve all the communities here in Brooklyn and the surrounding New York area. A lot of what I do is environmental education programming in our environmental education center. Every day we have several groups of schools come to us for field trips. In the summer we also offer camps to come for us for day programs as well. And we use the park as kind of an outdoor classroom or an outdoor laboratory in addition to our indoor space here. And in the environmental center, we have a lot of animals. All the animals in our space are reflective of things that are found in the park or around the New York City area. So all the fish here are actually caught by us right outside along the East River. The Brooklyn Bridge Park borders the East River, which is an estuary. We go out seining over the summer with a big net, and we're able to scoop up all these different organisms.
Now, as the listeners can hear, we're right underneath the bridge where the subway runs over, but they might not be able to know that this stretch of riverfront that you're on is used to be heavily industrial, and now it's in the process of a huge amount of change. What's going on here?
So over the last several decades, both in the East River and the Hudson River, you've seen a decline in the amount of pollutants entering the river. Of course, here in the city, we still have issues with combined sewer outflow because we have a sewage system that, when it gets overflowed with rainwater, has to flush out everything instead of bringing it to the sewage treatment plant first. So there are still some water quality issues in regards to that, but there's a lot of great organizations that are either advocating for cleanups along these waterways or are avidly doing water quality tests and monitoring the quality of our water here.
So what's the overall goal of the Environmental Education Center?
It's basically just to inform and educate the public on the different types of ecology and wildlife that are found here in New York. A lot of people don't realize that, you know, there are many different mammals in New York City, or that these rivers are not just purely trash-filled and polluted. There are rich ecosystems there. We catch seahorses. We find starfish, pufferfish, black sea bass, a lot of different things. And it's always enjoyable for me to see the faces of kids lighten up as we actually pull out these animals from the river.
Now, we're located about, 160 miles north of here on the Hudson River. Is this stretch of the East River connected somehow to our ecosystem?
Yes. So the East River is technically not a river. It's a tidal strait, which means it's connected to two bigger, larger bodies of water. One of those being the Atlantic Ocean, and the other one is the Long Island Sound. However, we also get water coming into the estuary here, the East River, through the Bronx River, which, of course, is then connected to the Hudson River. So it's true that there is water that is maybe at one point up at Troy, and it'll trickle down and possibly enter the East River down here.
And what are the big challenges of this ecosystem here, the water especially?
Probably providing a place that is not only suitable for wildlife, but also humans. People use the waterways for a variety of different reasons. Of course, it's not quite used as industrially as it used to be. We don't see huge factories, at least down here, right along the river anymore. But boats and barges still come by. Those things will, in some capacity, impact the organisms in the river. And it's trying to find that balance between making the river here a place for people to use, also to use recreationally, and making sure that water is safe so that they can do things like kayak and boat, and maybe, who knows, one day even go swimming.
Yeah, it's amazing to look at the changes here, because when I lived in New York City 20, 30 years ago, the river was something to look at but not get too close to. And now you see the water taxis and the pathways and all that. I'm struck by the network of trails that are being built up right here on the riverside. What's the goal there?
So providing recreational access and just bringing people close to the water was the goal. In this park, it's not purely just bulkhead. There's a lot of softer shorelines, which is an advantage not only to connect people back to those waterways, but also to provide some methods of stabilization for the shoreline, especially with all of the major storms and hurricanes we've seen in recent years. A big thing is creating these shorelines that are ecologically enhanced and can break up the big waves that come through, so that we don't have giant waves going over the piers and just flooding everything.
So what would a typical visit to the Environmental Education Center comprise of? Who comes here and what do they do?
So the answer is everyone comes here. We designed the space so that it can be used and appreciated by people of all ages. We get kids as young as, you know, babies still in strollers, to adults that, you know, come in and tell us about the changes, the dramatic changes that have happened here along this waterfront, how they remember what things used to look like before there was a park. What's great about the space is, in addition to all of our programming for school groups and students, we also have the center open 4 days a week to the public, and we call those our open hours. And during that time period, families and basically anyone, tourists, people that are just wandering up and stumble upon us, can come into the center, explore our various exhibits. We have educators here that can help facilitate your experience. It's also very open to you just exploring it on your own and getting what you want out of it.
How is this all paid for?
We definitely rely heavily on donors to the Conservancy, as well as applying for many state, local, and governmental grants.
What do you see in the future here? What would, if anything that you wanted could happen, what would that be?
That's a good question. Well, we are quickly outgrowing our space for sure. And my hope is that as we are able to continue fulfilling our mission of educating people on the East River estuary here and just environmental science as a whole, hopefully we can find the means to expand the number of programs and maybe even possibly the facilities that we have here to house all those programs.
Great. And how could folks who hear about this on the radio find out more about your project here?
You can visit brooklynbridgepark.org. You can find out all the information about the park, all the public programs and events that happen in the park, as well as everything involved in our environmental education department. I'd say if you have the chance to come down to Brooklyn, visit the park. It's not only an amazing park, it has great views of the New York City skyline, but it's probably your best opportunity to get really up and close to the water as you can while you're in the city.
That was Christina Tovich, environmental educator at the Brooklyn Bridge Park Conservancy's Environmental Education Center in New York City, brought to you by WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce.
Just wanted to mention the enormous noise you hear is the sound of the subway going overhead. For those just tuning in, I'm Annie Borthwick.
And I'm Megan Marone. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
We are lucky enough to be joined in the studio now by Devin Franklin, Director of Programs at the Flying Deer Nature Center. Welcome to the studio.
Good evening. Thank you.
Flying Deer is a wilderness school and community dedicated to mentoring children, youth, adults, families. It's located not far from Troy in New Lebanon, New York, and they engage in this work through creative programming based around survival skills, naturalist routines, and wilderness rites of passage.
Devin has loved exploring in and learning about nature since early childhood, and he's been walking the wilderness path ever since. Welcome, Devin, to our Urban Environmental Education Campus in North Troy and WOOC Radio.
Thank you.
Devin studied survival, tracking, and awareness skills with the Wilderness School in Maine and the Tracker School in New Jersey. He trained in naturalist mentoring and community building skills through the Wilderness Awareness School and the Vermont Wilderness School, and he received a degree in environmental education from Prescott College in Arizona.
So, Devin, can you tell us about the Flying Deer Nature Center and what is at the heart of the program?
I'm going to start with the simple answer, which is a happy child. When I think of the heart of what we do at Flying Deer, which is a nonprofit nature school, it's really about bringing children alive and bringing out their deep happiness. I'm picturing right now a child, let's say 5 years old, and you can invite you to imagine this with me, and her eyes are alive with the light and the happiness, and her smile is so wide that it's like touching her ears, and she has no shoes and socks on because she's working her toes into some squishy mud, into a mud puddle that she's kind of like, this is kind of, I can't believe I'm doing this, but I'm loving it. It's so fun. And she has friends around her who she's calling over, come on, try this. And they're having fun outdoors. And really happy. So if I had to really simplify it down to one thing, I'd say happy children. And of course, what we do is not only about children. We're getting everybody outside, whether it's into the deep forest or into a park, and encouraging people to work their toes into the mud. Maybe not always literally, but really enjoying the outdoors in that way.
Well, it's so great to have you here. And I've worked with kids since I was a kid. And some people, like this woman, Heather Menzies, who I'm reading her book right now, talk about how children have something which she calls a nature deficit disorder. And could you speak on that image that you began with to describe your center? You haven't described an organization or a structure at all yet, which is pretty cool. You just gave us an image of joy and connection. So can you speak on NDD and just your thoughts?
Yeah, so I believe that term nature deficit disorder was created by Richard Louv, who wrote...
she did give him credit. I just remembered.
Yeah. And he wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods. And I believe that's really in reference to the trend that we're seeing. And the trend is fewer and fewer children finding their way outdoors, literally out of doors, and onto the grass, onto the dirt, onto the mud, onto the leaves and sticks, and having some space to explore it. Because if you take a young child and allow them to be out there and give them the safety and give them the permission and give them the access to the elements, even if it's just a little park down the street, they're going to come alive. I've seen it over and over again of no matter who they are, and if they feel safe, they're going to come alive in a way that a lot of people are recognizing is becoming more and more scarce as a phenomenon, right? I mean, the kids just aren't having that unstructured time to play outdoors as much as in previous generations, And so people who study this phenomenon and how it fits into, our social, effects and, they're really doing studies about how that impacts people, how it's impacting these children. And I picked out what I feel is the most important thing, which is their happiness. But their physical health, their creativity, their ability to problem solve, their ability to work together, healthy relationships, those are all affected too.
We're joined in the studio also by youth intern Trayvon Votrin. Trey, did you want to ask a question about the Flying Deer Center, how youth are involved?
How can youth get involved, and how can youth like me who don't live with a lot of land and stuff like that, how can we get involved more with the world that we're living on?
Well, that's a great question, and what you and I and Kathy, who works here, what we just did not long ago, within the last hour, the sun was setting, right? And we were two blocks outside of the sanctuary here, down the street, and in one of the lots that the sanctuary works with. And it's being allowed to grow. There's vines there, and there are, natural, indigenous plants coming out. There's the pokeweed. And as a result of that, there's some birds that, are allowed to come and feed. But we went over there and we were checking out what grows there, what lives there. And we found some seeds. You showed me this. I have it right here, a seed pod from the tree that I said, I've never seen that before. And you said, well, in the summer they look like peas. And I said, well, now it doesn't look like a pea. It looks like, beans in a clear casing. And then, we took some of the bark from one of the vines and made this out of it. It's, if you can imagine this, it just looks like twisted rope, and it is. And it can be used. This stuff is strong enough to make, tie my shoelaces with, to use as shoelaces. And so using things that we find, on that piece of land there. So it's really just as simple as finding someone who's willing to get out there, right? I mean, that's all it is, and spend some time and explore. But I think a key to that is connecting with someone who knows what's safe, because I think there's a lot of fears, right, of what's going to hurt me,
All the berries and stuff that grow on the trees.
Yeah, what berries, can I eat, and what's going to poison me? There's some plants that could, give me a rash if I touch them. There's like poison ivy.
Yeah.
And that was just in a little, empty lot. But then if you go into a park and there's, a little bit of forest there, well, what animals there? Are there anything there that could hurt me? And so there's a lot of fears and myths that need to be dispelled. And you just find someone who is a little bit knowledgeable about that, who can give you feeling of safety to explore that. So I'd say that's the main thing, finding who's around who wants to explore outdoors with you.
Trey's question and your response brings up a question that I have about the structure, how you run Flying Deer. And we also have Masha Miller in the studio. Did you want to ask about that, Masha?
I have two questions. Who the heck is Flying Deer? And how are you guys? Is there a person named Flying Deer? And what the heck is Flying Deer mean?
Good question.
And how did you take it over? Tell that story, please.
Masha, it's good to see you here. Masha has been involved in Flying Deer, which, as I mentioned, is a collection of nature programming that works with kids of all ages, adults, families. Let me just give an example of some of the things that we actually do there, because I haven't explained, as you pointed out, what's the structure? Let's say there's a child who's homeschooled, And this child is what you just said, Trayvon. You know, how do I get involved? Well, we have a few different places. We have a place in Williamstown and in Sheffield, Mass, and in New Lebanon, New York, where our center is. And these kids who are homeschooled can come with other kids who are homeschooled and spend a day and learn what you can eat out there and what you can't, and learn how to take what materials are out in the woods and make a campfire to warm yourself, or make some tea, or even how to make a shelter and cuddle into it and shed the rain off of it. So that would be, you know, that's an example of what we do for kids who are homeschooled. But then we'll work with schools, and schools can come down and have a field trip to our land there. Or we do after-school programs, of course, summer camps. And then there's a lot of programs for adults, too. And so you asked about the name Flying Deer, and that was given to the founder, Lenny Brown. Lenny and Deborah Brown are the founders of Flying Deer Nature Center. And ever since... you know, it began, they have just had a passion for, Lenny was and is a phys ed and health teacher at public school in New Lebanon, and he has had a real gift in working with kids. And so some of his teachers saw that and encouraged him to start a place where, you know, he could pass this on to the kids in his backyard.
Can I pop in with a question on the thing that lighted up my imagination in the introduction, is that you do wilderness rites of passage. What is that about? Because in working with teenagers for a number of years, there are a lot of questions about what it means to become an adult in 21st century America. What is that line? You know, I mean, yeah. So could you just explain what you do with people, and why is it essential to get in touch with plants and trees and animals in order to become an adult?
Yeah. So a rite of passage is literally it means, you know, a specific way to guide someone from one life stage into another life stage. And so in this case, I think you're referring to coming of age rites of passage, which would mean...
I guess I assumed you meant coming of age rites of passage when I saw rite of passage.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really the programming that we have most designed and established is for coming of age rites of passage. But just as a quick reference, you know, a death of a family member is a rite of passage. Birthing a child is a rite of passage. And in our community, because there's Flying Deer Nature School is a school, it's an organization, but it's also a community has just grown around it, much like I imagine here at the sanctuary. And when those important events happen, a marriage or a birth or a death, the community comes together and offers support for that rite of passage moment. But as far as coming of age rites of passage, when a child is entering adolescence and leaving behind their childhood, that is a really great and really important moment in time to spend time with that person in a community context and to say, I see you, I care about you, I like you, I respect you, and you're going through changes. Life is not going to be the same as it was. You're going to enter adolescence, which is the slow ramp from childhood into adulthood. And it's got some confusion in there and challenges. And so, you know, our job as mentors in rites of passage is to say, let's get out into the wilderness, into the woods, and experience challenges that we intentionally design so that you can realize that you can make it through those challenges, and so therefore you can make it through the challenges that are going to be coming ahead. So when I say challenges, we mean can you develop the skills that you need to be able to go out into the woods and make a fire on your own? Can you spend the night in the woods alone by yourself?
is that the extent of the danger? Because, I mean, it's interesting, the coming of age rites of passage, you know, my mind's thinking of all the great stories, but it always involves danger, facing shadow, facing darkness. So this is done in a safe way, but a challenging way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's done in a safe way, but and Masha went through the rite of passage for girls at Flying Deer Nature Center called Moon Tribe.
So, actually, I have a question for you. One, what is Moon Tribe, the rite of passage? And two, what is sacred fire? What are those two different, the same and different? Sometimes we collaborate and get together with Hakoko.
Yes, so
I need to know the both for those two.
Well, really, the difference that I want to focus on between those two is the Moon Tribe is for is girls' rites of passage, and Sacred Fire is boys' rites of passage, and they're slightly different curriculum. But what they actually have in common is they both involve meeting regularly once a month as a group. Let's say, you know, 12, 13-year-old. Youth, and they get together once a month, and we're getting outside, and we're having fun is the main thing. Having a good time, laughing together, saying, okay, it's kind of a cold, rainy day today. Who wants a fire? Well, let's make one, and let's push ourselves to see how well we can work together as a team to make that. And then when the students become comfortable with that experience, then, okay, now it's time for you to, you know, learn, test your ability to make your own fire, because...
We were never called students in Moon Tribe. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thanks for correcting that.
Well, maybe in your little, at the girls area, we weren't. I don't know about your hooligan guys.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the Moon Tribe. But and... Really, what they have in common is a culmination where the youth are spending the night out in the forest on their own. And like you said, what's dangerous out there? Well, a lot of it's in our heads and isn't really actually a real danger. And so that's part of the learning, is going through a difficult challenge and realizing, looking back and realizing, my fears about it were way more scary and challenging than what I actually experienced. It's empowering.
Would you, we have to close, but could you take one more question from Trayvon and then give us some information on how people could get involved? It'd be great if you could come back and talk to us about community. Okay. So one last question from Trey.
So nowadays, like most teenagers just sit around, sit on their phones and stuff. What is your message to them to, like, make them, like, want to come out more and enjoy nature?
Oh, boy. So, if I were to give a message to these wonderful people, I would just have to say this. You are wonderful people, and I know you are awesome, and I wish that... You know, I had already met you, and I may not ever meet you, but I will tell you this. If you find someone who understands the outdoors and the grass and the trees and the wind, and that it's okay and safe to be out there and have fun out there, and you allow yourself, and you meet and you find someone, and you allow yourself to be guided out there and take a risk and get out there and open yourself, you will have the best time of your life. You will have so much fun. And the phones are good. The phones are helpful. And alongside that, you will find something that is just, it's not even the same. It's
more
so,
you will. Than the cell phones.
Well, you'll feel it. The people, if you take a chance and do it, you'll feel the truth in yourself. You'll be like, you'll know it, you know? So I wouldn't listen to me and trust that. I'd say, prove me right or prove me wrong.
Yeah.
And go try it and see what happens.
You have been listening to Devin Franklin, Director of Programs at the Flying Deer Nature Center. Devin, it looks like we can get more information at flyingdeernaturecenter.org. Do you have any final words for us?
I would say, if you want to come meet us, come to Flying Deer Day. which is our community picnic day. And it's June 16th. It's a Saturday, June 16th. And it's a lot of fun. And that's a good way to just come and see who's here and connect.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I hope you can come back on the show and talk to us about strategies for building community. Thank you to Masha Miller and to Trayvon Votrin for coming into the studio with a youth perspective and a Flying Deer alumni perspective. So thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Website address and number. We're going to have the physicist David Borton. He's back again with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. This week, he and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone finish a discussion on the high cost of fossil fuel.
The bigger man uses less fossil fuels. All right. What about you? Are you big enough to not use fossil fuels?
I am a human who wants to be big enough to have a solar boat. The specificity of the term passive solar home. If you are in an apartment on 6th Ave, we're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media on 6th Avenue. Where do you suggest people start thinking about these things? Say you're just paying rent to your landlord, you're paying your National Grid bill. Where do you go? Passive solar sounds nice. Do you talk to people about getting more institutions to be solar? Do you talk to your landlord?
Whether your landlord pays for it or that you pay for it, you're going to be more comfortable if you do something about your windows and doors and make it so you don't have those drafts.
Sure. There's some saran wrap on my windows right now.
Okay. It helps, right?
That's a petroleum-based plastic that's sealing in the draft.
Okay. But the amount of petroleum there is probably a couple of ounces, and a couple of ounces of gasoline won't even get you a mile. So it's negligible amount of plastic, and it saves relatively large amounts of fossil fuels.
It's similar to the question of electric cars. The whole idea of getting an electric car or even a hybrid, you know, sometimes those decisions come down to pure economics of survival. So any thoughts on that? We're running out of the amount of burnable fossil fuels that a lot of people are speculatively basing their investments on. So do you think that the companies that are controlling our decisions are going to be shifting towards these energy efficient choices more and more?
Yeah, they're going to have to. And a lot of car companies are already shifting toward electric cars for just that reason. Mm-hmm. They see that as the future that's coming. If it's coming, and you talk about people that have to live just the way they can, electric cars are going to be cheaper than the fossil fuel cars. So that's coming.
I was watching this video on Google. They're talking about the self-driving electric cars that they're creating right now. Rather than changing infrastructure, we're changing cars.
If you were living in the 1950s, how would you go down the street in an electric streetcar?
There were electric streetcars in Troy in the 50s? Where, San Francisco?
No, lots of places.
Really?
Yeah. Back then, there were electric streetcars that you could take from here to Boston.
Oh, really?
If you went this line and then that line and then the other line, it wasn't, you know, one superliner train track, but you could do that. The car companies and the oil companies and the rubber tire companies got together and bought up these electric trolleys so that people would have to buy cars.
Don't forget about those greedy gnomes at Goodyear.
Well, all I'm saying is...
not just Ford and Cadillac.
All I'm saying...
Shell and BP.
All I'm saying is...
It's the tire people, too.
That this was a political thing, this was an economic thing that was forced on the country back in the 1950s.
From what I understand, and two, we've always had fuel cell technology, right?
Fuel cells are a whole other subject.
Yeah.
And so,
isn't that true? Even at the turn of the century, there was fuel cell technology. They could have gone down that road as opposed to gas cars. But anyway, is that true?
No. There were electric cars, but they weren't fuel cell powered. They were mostly secondary battery cells, some primary battery cells. We could talk about batteries another time.
All right. Any final words, David?
Yeah. You haven't mentioned population. The more people we have, the more fossil fuels we're trying to burn. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that will help get to a lower amount of carbon dioxide is going to be less people on the planet.
That's an issue that hits home very personally for a lot of people.
Certainly.
I mean, what are your implications with that? You know, we've got population booms around the world right now.
I'm saying that's part of the problem that people don't talk about.
Another part of cultural decisions, too, in terms of what it means to have a quote-unquote normal life would be to not only have that idea of upward mobility, but what you do with your adult life. A whole nother discussion, though. So yeah. any other final words? So you want us to just consider population?
Well, I basically talk about physics, but you talked about climate change, and climate change is in part driven by population increase.
Thank you so much for being here. This has been a special climate edition of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. Thanks, David.
Oh, thanks, Megan. It's always fun to chat.
That was local scientist, educator, and solar boat builder, David Borton, and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone with Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. They were speaking about the high cost of fossil fuel consumption. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine every Tuesday to catch Dr. Borton and his popular science segments. That segment was engineered by our youth intern, Trayvon Votrin.
Annie and I are lucky enough to be joined in the studio by two editors from the Alt, Katie Cusack and Luke Stoddard-Nathan. Welcome back to the studio.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You.
Thank you for traveling here, and hope you've had a good day. Would you like to just start filling us in on what the weekly news from the Alt is going to be?
Gladly, I'll start. This week, I had two Troy stories, one of which is about how the city of Troy really, really wants to win this year's Downtown Revitalization Initiative grant. It's a $10 million state grant. The last 2 years in the Capital District, Hudson, the city of Hudson, and also Glens Falls won. Mm-hmm. Troy tried to win both times, but was unsuccessful. One time they pitched the Marina District, which is sort of, it might even come up along the river all the way up to where we are sitting right now. And then the year before, or the more recent year, they pitched the RAD District. And I forget, honestly, what RAD stood for, but it was a more downtown kind of southern by the water as well. But we didn't win. And this year, we have redoubled our efforts. And last week, the city asked a nonprofit that it controls to pitch in $10,000 to help it hire a consultant to kind of guide the application process, kind of on the understanding that, well, spending $10,000 to hire a consultant to help us like kind of hold public hearings and do all this other stuff to help us try to put together a really strong application to win $10 million is a pretty good ratio of spending money to potentially getting money. I think last year there were about six different applicants of other cities, and Troy was one of them. So there's not that many other cities usually competing, so it seems worth a shot. So, and then the other story, moving right along, I'm doing this new column where I hang out in local courts and watch things happen and just kind of keep an eye out. And last week, which was the inaugural edition of the column, I hung out in Troy City Court during a bunch of eviction proceedings, and I kind of... So during eviction proceedings, sometimes the tenants will request what's called an abatement hearing, which basically says where tenants will present their case and say, I think I'm entitled to a break on my rent for this month or last month or whatever it is, because conditions in my apartment were so unsanitary, or because things weren't up to code, or because there was a lack of heat or whatever the case may be. And then the judge will hear both sides, and you know, there may be witnesses or documents produced, and then the judge will make a determination as to whether that is or not, whether they're entitled to a break on rent. And what Troy City Court used to do, but no longer does, is require the tenants as a prerequisite for that hearing taking place, requiring tenants to deposit the disputed amount of rent before, kind of put it in escrow before the hearing was held. And last year, I found this out because I was sitting in city court and two landlord attorneys, in two separate instances, a tenant requested this hearing, and the landlord's attorney, as the judge was kind of setting up, was doing scheduling, the landlord's attorney was like, oh, are you going to make them put the money in escrow? And the judge was like, no, we don't do that anymore. Talk to county court about that. And what had happened was last year, legal aid assisted with a tenant's appeal, and a county court judge said, city court, you're not allowed to do that, which seems like a victory for tenants' rights people and tenants more generally. Legal aid folks are really excited about that decision, and so are the United Tenants of Albany, who talked to me for this story. The coda is that apparently this practice is still fairly widespread in local courts throughout the state. Indeed, in Schenectady, they still require this deposit to be made as a prerequisite for holding these kinds of abatement hearings.
So to be clear, can I ask a question on that? It has been the case that you can't even get your case heard until you come up with that money.
It's sort of like a case within a case. It's a hearing to, you know, the landlord has brought the tenant to court trying to evict the tenant, saying, you know, you haven't paid rent in X amount of time, right? And you owe me this amount of money. Judge, please make a determination. You know, let's hear out the facts. You know, let's make this, you know. And then the tenant, maybe as a defense, will say, well, it's true I haven't paid rent, but I think I'm entitled to a break on my rent because the conditions in the apartment haven't been adequate. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, so the case was for, I don't know how long, but in Troy City Court prior to this decision, it was the case that the tenants would have to post the money that was due, allegedly due for that rent, as a prerequisite for the hearing to take place. And what happened in this case that the county court decided was this tenant didn't have or brought like half the money to the judge, and the judge said, where's the rest? Like, he didn't accept the money, and so the hearing didn't take place. And so...
What happens when the hearing doesn't take place?
Oh, then you're not entitled. Then you can't make your case to get a break on the rent.
So this is an interesting situation because from the very small landlords are really feel totally compromised. So, you know, you have two different sides, and both sides are feeling, I'm ruined by this. So it's going to be an interesting thing to talk about. And you might want to talk to the Capital District Association of Real Property Owners. It's called CADARPO, and it's a very interesting group of mostly very small landlords.
I'm sure they have a different perspective than the tenants' associations. Yeah. And then Katie has other news.
Some sort of like arts and entertainment events you can read about in this upcoming issue tomorrow. One of them is a short film that's going to be premiering at Troy Kitchen tomorrow night at 8 p.m. It's called Tree Boy, and it was created by two local filmmakers. It's a very avant-garde performance piece that's become a short film. Very little dialogue, and it sort of explores feelings of isolation and the idealism of different locations and destinations. So that feeling when you're living in a really congested city and you have to get out into the wilderness to feel like you're a different person, and then you get there and it doesn't feel the same as you thought it would, and then sort of exploring the opposite way as well. So it should be an interesting film to see, and you can read a write-up about it. I spoke to the filmmakers for the piece tomorrow. And then also there's a show Thursday night at the River Street Pub in Troy by Super Dark Collective, who's they throw a lot of shows mainly in Saratoga, but they've been doing a lot in Troy, especially at River Street Pub on Thursday nights. So they have a almost weekly schedule there. If you're ever looking to see a show and you're a fan of any experimental indie hip hop or not hip hop, hardcore, like punk bands, that's your scene.
Is River Street Pub going to be their home base now because One Caroline Street down?
Yeah. I'm wondering, I did read that they are going to be relocating to somewhere else in Saratoga, but they haven't announced that they are going to, where they're going to be in Saratoga every Monday, but they do intend on continuing the Super Dark Mondays that they're having. So we'll have to stay tuned on what they're up to.
Well, thank you so much for being in the studio. We look forward to our all updates. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Megan Marone.
And I'm Annie Borthwick. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.